Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we bring you a guest from Denver, Colorado. Stephen Palmer is our guest today, who is a partner at Forbes Tate. And we're going to hear all about his work there and his very, very interesting career that he has had. Stephen, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you.
Glad to be here. Great day to be alive. Thank you.
So, Stephen, I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and I noticed that your first job straight out of college was with a very well-known congressman. So what was your first campaign government experience, and how did you land a job with such a well-known congressman?
Are we talking Wayne Allard and John Kasich?
John Kasich. Yes, John Kasich.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I actually worked for Wayne Allard first. So right out of the gates, I was student body president at the University of Northern Colorado. And, you know, study business. And what I found is I appreciated understanding and knowing business, but when I took a job for a company out of college, I didn't enjoy it. And Wayne's campaign manager at the time, Roy Palmer, gave me a buzz and said, "Hey, we need help in the district. You were the president of the school that we're going to be running against that former president of the school." And so I came on board to the campaign, worked for $250 a week. And my first day on the job, they said, "We need you to drive Wayne and Joan down to Denver for a very important meeting." So we hopped in the car and drove. What should have taken us about an hour and 15 minutes, we pulled in at about 45. They walked us into the basement of a church right downtown across from the Brown Palace Hotel. And then there were three knocks on the door, and in walked these gentlemen like this, look around the room. They said, "All clear," and the door swung open and walked President Reagan. I was locked in at that moment. It was the first day on the job. I said, this is it.
And you had no idea that President Reagan was going to be there?
No idea. And, you know, Roy just said, "Hey, you got to learn visit with the Congress, you know, with Wayne and Joan. This is your first day." And it was certainly one of the best days of my life and one of the best first days I've ever had. And, you know, it was a very hard-fought campaign. And, you know, Colorado was a very different state back then. CD4 is a rural district. You know, Northeastern and all of Eastern Colorado. It's at the time that district was bigger than many states, and we won. Wayne invited me, Roy Palmer, and Doug Benevento, who's now number two at EPA, to join him in DC. And we all drove across the country, and that's kind of where it all began. Really transformative. And, you know, I had the truly blessed to work for 3 years for Wayne and then shared staff with John Kasich on the House Budget Committee as a budget associate. And that's really where I got to put to use my deep knowledge of business with my business degree and applying that to policy and looking at the federal budget. But you also figured out pretty quickly that FASB rules don't hold in budgeting of in the federal government. It's a very different world, but it was really, really fantastic.
Before you get to Congressman Kasich, so how did you, first, you were president of the student body in college?
Yeah.
Wow. So you clearly had some interest in politics.
I did. You know, I reflect on that. You know, early in my life, you know, we lived right on two different congressional districts. We had CD1, which was Pat Schroeder's district, and then CD3 on the other side, which, so I had the occasion of handing out flyers for Pat Schroeder. Admittedly, most of them ended up in the dumpster. And at the same time, I had the occasion of working with Jack Swigert when he was running. And obviously, you know, Jack was a tremendous man, and he ultimately ended up passing away before he took the seat that he won. But it really enabled me to understand at a very young age, you know, parties are different, but people is what mattered. And for me, it's always been person over party. So when I went to college and I ran for student body president, it was in part, I needed to make money. And at my college, if you were elected to student government, you were given a full academic scholarship because they recognized that you were dedicating your time and your energies to lead and to be impactful. And so I really did it out of a sense of urgency. The first year that I was vice president of faculty affairs, which is probably the greatest title ever, but it, you know, I served on the faculty senate. So what I learned there is a lot of behind the scenes of how a university is run, the different viewpoints that members of faculty have, and and their contribution that they made to the university. And then as student body president, I had the occasion of actually mirroring the president of the university, because our student government was structured identical to the administration, where there were 11 vice presidents and one president. But the real story coming out of that was the day after the election, the headline read, 23 votes does not a president make, because I won by 23 votes. And I thought, holy smokes, welcome to politics. It was pretty harsh, but it molded me and really gave me a tremendous foundation to the person that I've continued to develop and become.
Boy, so free tuition.
Yeah.
What a great deal.
It was tremendous. You know, I always reflect upon, you know, college athletes are great. You know, they get to go to college and do what they do on the court or in the field. But there's a lot of students who really aren't that good at sport. And, you know, and maybe they're an okay student or a good student, but they have other things that they can contribute. And I just fundamentally believe that, you know, because UNC afforded that opportunity, that it really enabled students to actively participate in a very meaningful level and develop life skills and go on and do tremendous things. You know, from my student government, the student body president before me was a gentleman by the name of Kurt Kundrat. He went on to be a president of North American Canada for Fleshman Hilliard. Chris Lepore was a student, was a vice president of student government 2 years after me. He's now head of Johnson & Johnson State Government Affairs, USA. There's just a tremendous pathways that are developed. One of our classmates never ran for student government, but he advised us all. And that's Dave Bernhardt, who's now Secretary of Interior. So we had like this really great experience that we're able to build upon because the school recognized it. I've come to learn, sadly, that the school no longer does that. You know, so, you know, I think one of the gifts that I'd like to give back to that school is the ability to fund a scholarship for student leaders, because it's so important. It's so very important.
Yeah. What a great program, because, you know, as you just mentioned, you know, you have your athletes and you have your incredibly bright students, but to encourage people to get involved with government like that and to provide free tuition, that's a great program. So how did you get first get hooked up with Wayne? How did that come about?
His daughter, Christy, was one of our vice presidents, and she had talked with her father about me. And, you know, and I think one thing I always try to bring to work is I just work hard and put everything I have into it. And he needed some help, you know, kind of organizing some of the youth vote in Northern Colorado, Greeley and Fort Collins in particular. And so it was just a perfect marriage. It really was. It was, you know, Wayne is, it's just as good as they are in terms of people. He's a plotter with the D, you know, and just slowly would work and work and work. And it's a lost art, gentleman to the core. And I loved it. I loved working with him and believed in him. And in fact, just yesterday, his wife, Joan, celebrated her 75th birthday. And, you know, we had a little online birthday celebration. It was really great because it's a relationship and friendship that will last a lifetime, which is really wonderful.
And tell us about your work with Congressman Kasich.
It was a shared position with the budget associate. So he, at the time, was ranking member of the House Budget Committee. And so as a budget associate, I served at the pleasure of him as well as Wayne Allard. And it was really an interesting time because, you know, these were early days for Kasich. And, you know, for a lot of, you know, he takes a lot of shots. But one thing that I've always liked about John is that he's passionate about the work. And his heart is always in it. You know, I remember it was early days on the Hill, you know, it just happened. And I recall when, you know, a big part of our project of work was when President Clinton introduced his budget. It was the first time ever that the House Budget Committee actually crafted a response budget to what the president put forward. And it was called Cutting Spending First. And it shook up a whole lot of activities on the Hill. The appropriators were ticked off. The authorizers were very angry at the budget committee because essentially we took the budget and we spent hours, hundreds of hours, and rewrote the budget and came out with deficit spending suggestions on how you actually could get spending under control. But it changed the paradigm with which budgets were received from that day forward. So it was really formative because it was part of that curve. You know, I remember when we had leaders coming in to meet with us at the staff level, we had Vin Weber come in and talk to us about kind of how Medicaid came about and how Medicare was developed and the whole history of that. And it's this whole patchwork quilt that never really was designed to work together. And so we had to think through, do we break it down? You really have to tear it down and rebuild it back up. Obviously, that didn't happen. You had Ross Perot come in and sit down with us and talk about, you know, his thinking around deficit spending and way government should reform and rethink. And this was all on Kasich's leadership. And so it was really formative. And John, governor, he's a good man. And it really helped me kind of develop a deeper insight and awareness and perspective for kind of how the country goes about doing business and things we should be doing differently, and really addressing the importance of managing, you know, a budget smartly. So yeah, super informative and very formative to me.
And so it was during that time that you came up with the budget that produced the first surplus, right? A long time. Yeah, that was quite something at the time.
Yeah, it was tremendous. And many of those proposals, you know, it threw up probably for some of the clients we look at today wouldn't be too happy with some of those things, but it had to happen, you know, because spending was way out of control and the mindset was just out of control for budgeting in Congress. It changed a whole lot of things. Obviously, now with COVID, you know, our budget's going to be in a really difficult place for quite a while because of the emergency spending that's had to take place. But yeah, it's a very critically important activity.
So you were clearly enjoying your work and quite busy diving into the budget and the budget process. Outside of work, what's the atmosphere like on the Hill for a young staffer? Was it a fun place to work?
It was. Yeah, it was really amazing. You know, I'm a Sigma Chi and I was a fraternity in college. And so when I moved to DC, I was able to help build out that network on my fraternity, national fraternity. And a little bit of the fraternity life continued on the Hill, right? Yes, the partying, but also the fellowship and getting together with brothers from all across the country. You know, still to this day, one of the most memorable times serving on the Hill is, you know, once a year, Steny Hoyer would organize all the Sigma Chi's who worked for the Congress and members included. And we would, you know, we would meet on the steps and we would take this picture and go out and have drinks afterwards and just talk about the fraternity. It was really great. And then an extension of that is obviously the lifestyle that you had to have as a staffer because you were paid a pittance to do the work you did, which was super impactful for the country. And then you'd live at the receptions. That's how you would eat. And then you'd play your softball games and that was your socialization. And then you'd go to the parties later on. And really it was a bipartisan celebration of all things that are good in the country. And to have, you know, people from all around the world, but more specifically all around the country, and to have the occasion to become friends with them and to learn about really what matters in their respective backgrounds and districts. It's pretty unbelievable because each of us, while we come from a different place, you know, each of us had something that impacted our life in a manner with which that kind of called us to serve and to work on the Hill. And I do view it as, you know, you're serving your country and you're serving your district. And even though the partisan differences may existed on some policy, you know, when you allowed yourself to just kind of get to the core of the person, it's like we're all similar in how we view the country. And I think that really made for some just amazing friendships. You know, I remember coming back from a committee meeting late in the night to our office and nobody was in the office. And it was like 9 o'clock. And I'm like, where is everybody? Because I know they're on the floor and we should be here. And I wandered down the hall and they were in Congressman Zeliff's office. Because we had Dave Camp right next to us. And we had Zeliff and Zimmer. So we had like this interesting, you know, Northeast in upper Midwest breakout, and around the corner was Henry Hyde, all the Illinois guys. But I walk into Zeliff's office, and my office is in there just whooping it up with them, and they're throwing back the Coors Light, and they're like, Palmer, do you know who this is? And I'm like, I have no idea who this is. And they go, do you know what his dad does? And I'm like, nice to meet you. My name's Mike Sununu. And I said, that's great, Mike. I'm Steve Palmer. What's your dad do, Mike? Like, I don't care. My dad's a traveling salesman. And obviously, Mike's dad was the chief of staff for Bush, but I didn't really care. I didn't care that his dad was the chief of staff. I cared that, you know, we were kind of in the same place, and he and I are still friends to this day. And to develop those types of friendships at a young age and just to kind of establish yourself, it's really cool. And I reflect on it. It's something I wish every person could have the experience. I really do. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And so what did you do when you left, and how did you decide when to leave and why? It must be tough to leave such a great work atmosphere. Because everybody we talk to, so many people say, oh, the greatest job I had was working on the hill. I couldn't, you know, I was surviving on beer and pizza. But yeah, so when did you decide to leave, and what did you do?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, it was a tough decision. I'm a Colorado boy, and I entered the hill at a senior level. I was in LA right out of the gate, and so I got a lot of the experiences in. But at the same time, I was growing a little bit tired of just life on the East Coast, and I wanted to get back home and, you know, get back to the mountains and kind of celebrate that. And so I started to look for opportunities, and essentially sit down with Roy. He's like, you know, why don't you just head on home and we'll help you find a job. So I left without a job and went back home. One thing Republicans don't do as well as Democrats is we don't have a field team. So when you go back home, you guys, it's on your own to find work. And transitioning from the hill to Colorado, or the hill to any city, it's tough because the jobs we hold on the hill are very unique. And while they're impactful, there's not those opportunities back home. But I was blessed, and I was able to hook on with the top lobby firm in the state at the time, called Hayes, Hayes & Wilson. Pancho Hayes and his dad, Frank Hayes, they were the first contract lobbyists in the state. And then the other two gentlemen were Wally Steele and Bill Artis. The four of them were really the kind of the pillars of the Colorado lobby early days. And so I had the occasion of working with them, and we had incredible clients: Pharma, Denver Broncos, Restaurant Association, the Tobacco Institute, and just a whole host of others. But I ran into some issues is our clients kept wanting to hire me and bring me inside. So,
well, that's a good sign. Note to our listeners, if your clients are trying to hire you, that's a good sign.
And so, you know, the first one that did it was the Tobacco Institute in U.S. Tobacco. I, along with Ted Trempa, ran a campaign in Colorado in opposition to a tobacco tax increase. And this was in 94-95 cycle. And we won at a time when every other state that was running that similar campaign lost. And after we won, U.S. Tobacco was like, hey, we'd really love you to come and work for us. We think it'd be great. So I ended up accepting that job, running the wine division at the time, which was Chateau St. Michel, Columbia Crest. But they wanted me to move to Greenwich, Connecticut. Beautiful area if you're a multimillionaire. Not so much if you're a 20.
Yes, U.S. Tobacco was based in Connecticut. That's correct.
25-year-old kid, you know, making, I think they paid me $38,000 a year living in Greenwich, Connecticut. I mean,
you would not have been living in Greenwich. You would have been commuting in. Yes.
So at the same time, however, and this is kind of the rest of the story, the Denver Chamber of Commerce offered me a job to head up their government affairs. And so I said, well, Chamber, I want to wait. I can't accept the job. I got to work some things. Meanwhile, I accepted the UST job. I wanted to see what it would be all about. And I lived in the Greenwich Hyatt for a couple of months. And I just decided, I said, it's not going to work. You know, I can't.
And this is like in 1995?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So I had two birds in the hand, and I kind of test rode one because it was the corporate road, right? I was like, oh, this will be good. And my second day on the job with UST, I was in the Gulf Stream. We flew from White Plains to San Diego. I think it took us like 3 hours because we flew at the curvature of the earth, and we flew so fast. But I also realized it's really tremendous, and you know, tremendous company, but it just wasn't me. And so I came back and went to work for the Denver Chamber and helped run their government affairs for a couple of years. And they were a client as well of ours.
So did the Denver Chamber take you for a ride on their jet to see you?
Oh, no.
I gotta say, Stephen, that's pretty impressive that you got a ride on the corporate jet across the country and you still had the ability to walk away. That's impressive.
Yeah, and I'm still friends with the UST folks. They're obviously now no longer UST. But yeah, again, it was just, I've always been able to kind of separate myself from kind of the attraction of what we do and kind of hone in on what matters. And this was just a decision of what mattered. But, you know, working for the city, for the Denver Chamber of Commerce at a time when we were starting to really put our stuff together relative to economic development in the state was super impactful work. And it was very formative to helping the city become what it is today. So many people think that Denver just all of a sudden just came out of nowhere. But I'll tell you what, the Denver Chamber of Commerce historically had a regional planning protocol in place that actually positioned them for the growth that they have today. We never relied on one sector of the economy for our growth. It was always, you know, four or five sectors growing in partnership with each other. And that it's a huge part as to why Denver is as strong as it is and the state is as strong as it is now as an economy. And to play a small role in that, you know, I reflect on it again, young 26, 27 year old, to do that was really, really impactful work at a young age, and for your listeners, I think it's really important that it's not so much where you end up. It's kind of the journey along the way. And you want to be super focused on not so much the destination, but taking advantage of every opportunity that you have, making the most of each part of that opportunity to help you become kind of a better person and a more impactful professional. Because each step along my career path has enabled the next door to be opened up, because from the chamber, you know, that's when pharma hired me, where that was like my first big step into multi-state government affairs. And that's, you know, in large part, multi-state government affairs is what I do today. And, you know, when pharma hired me, now I had worked with the head of pharma before on the state side, Kurt Malmgren, when he was at the Tobacco Institute, because I ran the campaign. And so when pharma had this opening, you know, he said, look, I'd love to have you come over and join us. You're young enough where getting on airplanes every day and flying around and working your tail off isn't going to really impact you that much, you know? And that Kurt loved doing that. He loved working people to death. But it was fun. And so I managed right out of the gate 14 states for pharma. And so here I am at 27 years old. I've already worked for tobacco. I've already done economic development. And now I'm going into the pharmaceutical industry, where the wars were beginning to happen in a very impactful way. And so foundational development and growth, and to now work in 14 states and manage and run strategy and hiring consultants across the country and working with member companies to protect and to grow and develop the industry, it was really significant, impactful work that, you know, to be a part of that was really spectacular. We were addressing some really big issues. You know, they don't seem so big now because the industry is so many of these issues have been resolved. But when preferred drug lists came out and states could tell you which drugs you can and can't provide patients, or when early days of bulk purchasing came out or 340B pricing came out, you know, I was part of that front line to help develop the foundational strategy and to either stop it from occurring or improving a bad bill to make it palatable for the industry. Very impactful work, but it also enabled me to develop a network of like-for-like professionals across the country in, you know, learning how to build teams, how to hiring up lobby teams, how to be smart about putting the right asset in play at the right time in particular theaters where the issues rose. It also gave me the ability and exposure to, you know, running an entire campaign, both grassroots, public affairs, direct lobbying, and polling, all to effectuate change. And then the role that, you know, political giving played in all of that. Super impactful. Again, 27 years old, and to be able to do that that age and to develop the skill set is, I feel very, very blessed in that regard.
So to go from the Denver Chamber to overseeing 14 states, that was quite a change and quite a jump. That must have been, and what's it like as you're overseeing 14 states and essentially, you know, one overall campaign, but 14 individual campaigns? I would assume that most of those already had lobbying firms in place, or did you have to hire a bunch? But you had to oversee that, come up with a strategy, as you mentioned, bring the resources together, figure out where to negotiate, where to fight. I mean, that is, that's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, it was. And it was eye-opening. Absolutely. I think what helped me through this whole activity was the ability to not have a command and control approach, but rather lead in partnership with others. And, you know, members of the task force, many of them were 15, 20 years older than I was, but they came out of the business side in the industry, right? Where I came out of the political and campaign side. And so it allowed for a really good marriage of skill set and to appreciate kind of each other's experiences in that regard to build out the team. It also was incumbent on me to trust the assets in place and also to to bring assets in place who could provide expert capabilities, you know, contract lobbyists in the field. You know, I reflect on it. Buddy Jones is the top lobbyist in the state of Texas and Hill Co-Partners. I was one of his first clients. And so we kind of grew up a little bit together. Now he's unbelievable. But to work with the likes of Buddy at very young age. And
he's unbelievable. What do you mean by that?
Oh, he's just such a good lobbyist. He's incredibly smart. He gets how a bill fundamentally does or does not become a law. And he takes the time to understand the issues in depthly. He gets what I call the concentric circles, like how everybody is connected kind of in the sequencing. And he knows how to kind of move through that process. Yeah, he's one of the best. And in fact, he's someone you should talk to because Hilco Partners, a little bit of a game changer in how Texas lobbying shops went about their business. Now there's a lot of firms like Hilco, but he was early days.
Like Hilco. What do you mean by like Hilco?
Oh, well, they're a full service integrated firm.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay.
In Texas.
So Buddy Jones, he's one of the best you've seen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Across the country.
All right, Buddy Jones, if you're listening, you're going to have to be a guest.
Yeah, I mean, he's as good as they get. He's so good. He represents every sports team in the state of Texas professionally. How do you represent them all? He's the bomb. He really is. But anyway, you know, to have the occasion to work with the likes of that and to learn from people like him. One thing, you know, going through business school in your capstone class, at least in mine, one of the items that they really impressed upon us is the importance of a board of directors. Right. Over a company. But at the same time, they said, you know, it's important that you as an individual need to have a board of directors, people that you can tap into and call upon when you're kind of working through issues relative to work or family or whatever the case may be. Buddy's on my board of directors and has been for many years. He's one of those people that I can reach out to and get advice and get unvarnished feedback.
What a great concept. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it works really well.
Lead in partnerships. That's also a great concept, particularly in our business. You know, there's a lot of egos and a lot of people that want to run things by command control. So I like the way you said that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned concentric circles.
Yeah.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, my belief is, you know, in politics, a lot of times people forget or don't take the time to understand that, you know, first off, elected officials all come from a home district, right? And everything is connected kind of behind the scenes at some level. And I always fundamentally try to make sure that we understand, you know, what is the connective tissue on, whether it be a particular member, a particular district, or a particular issue. And like, where do these circles come together? Because they do invariably. And then you apply strategies against it, whether it be a, you know, a public affairs component, a direct lobbying component, and that everything is connected. You know, members don't just pull ideas or solutions out of thin air. There's something that someone or somebody or something that's influenced kind of where they are and they're thinking onto something. And you kind of have to deconstruct that. At least that's my philosophy, to figure out, okay, how do you influence? And how do you do it in such a way that you're putting together a smart strategy that's based upon fact, but also reality? And something that I've always used is concentric circles. It's just kind of, you know, peeling the onion back and figuring out, okay, what makes this person or what makes this issue what it is? And then how do we influence it? You know, that's how I view concentric circles. And then making sure that you have strategy and messages that can intellectually, thoughtfully address those issues that are on the table. So, you know, that's my view on concentric circles. And then after pharma, I ended up going to a couple of the companies. I went to Bayer for a couple of years, and then we went through layoffs. I managed Western U.S. for Bayer, and then I went to TAP Pharmaceuticals. And it was, when I was at TAP, it was a great company, but, you know, when the partnership broke up and it went back to Abbott and Takeda, I was offered a job to go to Chicago and work for Takeda. And it was at the same time when Dutco Worldwide was actually looking for someone to re-energize their Colorado office. And so I was blessed with having an opportunity, again, of two choices. The Dutco choice was a little bit more risky because Craig Patty, who was president of Dutco, essentially said, look, you don't have any clients. We want to do something. We don't know what we want to do here. We'll get back to you. But meanwhile, why don't you try to start your business up, see if you can get some clients and see what happens. And I told Takeda at this time, I need a few more weeks to make my decision. Meanwhile, I was throwing my lure in the water and trying to win clients. Well, through the grace of God, I was able to land 3 clients in about 2.5 weeks. And I remember I called Craig up. I said, okay, I've got a couple of clients. He goes, what? And I said, well, yeah, I landed 2 clients. I've got a third one that's ready to sign. And he said, we're going to go to work together. He goes, anybody that can land a client within 2 weeks' time and on their own, he's like, I don't know what you're doing, but you're going to do it. And what I found out is that, you know, I enjoy pursuing and chasing business. I enjoy thinking through and identifying what is the emerging issue and how do you marry up an emerging issue with an opportunity. And you take that and you meld it into winning a client. And it's something that served me well and continues to serve me well. You know, I was at Dutco for about 7 years. Ultimately, when I left, I was running their national, state, and local practice. It was after we were bought by Huntsworth out of the UK. So early days, Dutco worldwide, as many of your listeners may know. I mean, we were the number one lobby firm in DC, and we were the number one national, state, and local practice, hands down, because it was the only national, state, and local practice in the business back then. And as a result of that, to be a part of that growth trajectory and that really unique client development opportunity, building a business, tremendously formative into the role that I hold now at Forbes Tate. Dutco Worldwide was the first firm to have a national governor's practice, you know, where clients would retain us specifically to help them develop relationships with governors across the country in all 50 states and to help bridge the intergovernmental affairs when Dutco is the number one DC lobby shop. And then to have this national, state, and local practice where, you know, you'd work with intergovernmental affairs for all the agencies and educate governors on the issues that mattered on the Hill and vice versa. And governors are some great lobbyists, right? You educate them on issues that are happening. Like, holy cow, we should really care about that. And so they would enter into the conversation and we would help advance that notion. It was impactful business. And so much of what I do at Forbes Tate now is foundational to what we did at Dutco Worldwide, where I now run our national, state, and local practice at Forbes Tate and have bridged over many of those best practices. The marketplace has changed a little bit because, you know, the Dutco model is more well known now. And so there's a handful of other firms that do it. But, you know, we're amongst the best. And, you know, our client load shows that we operate in that intersection, right? Being a top 10 lobby firm in DC and a top 5 national, state, and local practice, bipartisan. But yeah, it works pretty well. It's a great partnership.
How were you recruited or introduced to Forbes Tate?
Yeah. Jeff Forbes and I had worked on a couple of clients together, and I think we had a mutual admiration for each other's capabilities and ability to do the work in our fields of expertise. Allergan was one of the clients that we shared, and you know, my role with Allergan was to help with the governors and make the governors keenly aware of, you know, Allergan's core issues. And then one core issue in particular is when the hostile takeover of Allergan was taking place. And that's kind of when the partnering of an awareness of what I did and what Forbes Tate is doing and how there could really be this symbiotic relationship. And so when I made the decision to leave Grayling, which used to be Dutco, you know, I took about a year before I ultimately put a deal together with Forbes Tate, but it just made the right sense, you know, to merge my business inside with what Forbes Tate and what Jeff is wanting to do in terms of building out the national, state, and local practice. It was just the perfect timing for that conversation and for that growth to occur. And it's working really well. It's, you know, the business is growing. Clients recognize the value of our capabilities and operating that intersection of state and federal. And we bring forward, you know, deep insights, smart ideas, and strong capabilities on the state side, which is important, right? Clients value that. So yeah, that's kind of how we all came together.
Well, and there's so much activity at the state level. You know, pre-COVID, there was so much more activity at the state level. Obviously, yeah. Now with COVID, there's been a fair number of stimulus bills that have passed down in Washington. But for our listeners, can you give us an idea of how your time is spent overseeing a practice like that? Obviously, recruiting clients, overseeing clients, strategy, hiring staff, overseeing staff, all of the above?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because in, you know, in pandemic times,
it's a little different.
Yeah, really is. It's changed the model some for me. I've always lived the pandemic life. I live in the mountains out in Colorado. And so I work from my house and I pretty much always have, even though I've had all those jobs we spoke about, most of them were from, you know, my base camp in Evergreen, Colorado. So in terms of like becoming more comfortable and accustomed to working from home, that I addressed that years ago. What the pandemic has really taught me is the value of having the relationships across the country and just how good are they and how strong are they? And are they truly what I fundamentally thought they are? And I've been pleasantly surprised that the relationships are strong and that my ability to help clients achieve their objectives and to get the information they need in a timely manner and an insightful manner is strong today as it's ever been. I'm not flying around the country like I normally would, 150,000 miles a year. I mean, I feel like a day trader. I have three computers going all at once, you know, just constantly diving in and out of conversations and keeping the ball moving forward for clients. And, you know, I could be on a phone call with the governor in the Northeast and then hang up and be on a phone call with the governor's office in the Northwest, all within, you know, 2 minutes of each other. But that's the new normal. And one thing that's really been interesting is you understand this, you're a state lobbyist. Normally in state government affairs, there's a timeline in terms of, you know, January to April, May, it's crazy. But then it's a lifestyle job, right? May through October, things start to mellow out. And then November, December, you start to get a little bit crazy. Well, in COVID times, I mean, everything, the calendar is just rolling from 6 a.m. till 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. Zoom calls, conference calls constantly. And I think what we've all kind of gained a greater appreciation for, you know, better use of our time. Clients know that you're not on an airplane. So you're in front of your computer, you're doing a lot more calls. And then when I have gone on a couple of business trips in the last couple of months, I realized, golly, traveling is really inefficient. You know, I'm yes. Having to sit in this airport and I can't do a Zoom call, or I'm sitting on the plane for 3 hours. I can't get anything done. And so it's like a whole lot of reflective moments relative to like how we do our job. I do think it'll be fundamentally changed going forward. I think that much of the travel that we had done historically probably won't be happening as much just because people are like, hey, you can accomplish it in a Zoom call.
Yeah.
I don't think it, however, replaces the importance of a one-to-one relationship with elected officials. So a lot more travel will be tied to strengthening and building relationships with your core customer, which is the elected official in our case. But yeah, it's definitely created challenges. At the same time, it's created opportunities because we operate at the intersection of federal and state. You know, we are very focused on whether it be what's the impact of CARES dollars downstream. How do we help make governors aware of innovative technology, whether it be in testing, whether it be in curative treatments such as vaccines, which we're very involved with, whether it be in just baseline pharmaceuticals. You know, having a base foundation of healthcare has helped us as a firm and me personally quite well during this pandemic. Because what we've also discovered, at least I have, many of our clients who are not healthcare clients are calling on us to say, hey, can you walk us through what's going on in the vaccine space? Or can you explain to us what does the curve look like coming out of the pandemic? Right? Because they know their issues well, but they may not understand healthcare well. Mm-hmm. And so to provide that level of expertise and insight to clients has really been a value. The other great thing about it is, you know, Jim, I've represented Uber for 7 years, one of their, you know, longest standing gray-haired consultants. I don't have options, but that's okay. because I work for companies, so I wouldn't own the options anyway, right? So, but what's been great about working with Uber is, you know, here's a company early days, it was disrupting the marketplace, you know, breaking down walls, breaking glass to bring forward a super innovative business model. Right, to move people from point A to point B in a much more efficient way and to push down the cost of providing that service and to make it more readily available to consumers. And you fast forward to today, and you say, well, I don't get the core. What do you mean, Steve? You fast forward to today and you have, okay, you're in the middle of a pandemic. Could you imagine if we didn't have Uber Eats? Or could you imagine if people, you know, what would happen to the restaurants if there was not a core delivery service that could actually get food to people who need it? Or if there was not trips that Uber Health is providing for people to donate plasma, or that there were trips that couldn't be completed to get someone to a doctor in a safe manner because Uber Health didn't exist. You know, there's some really transformational things that occurred years ago that now have set us up for really success today. And then Uber is just a classic example of that. You know, my work for Uber is company-wide. I do I help them with strategy, help them think through big picture stuff. You know, Justin Kent hired me 7 years ago, and it's built into my contract. Legal term, I'm a Sherpa. that's the term that we use, that I'm the Uber Sherpa in the States. And so now I'm the Uber Health Sherpa, and helping them think through how do they become a partner with the states in helping deliver high quality healthcare and bend the cost curve, right? And to do that today, as we work through a pandemic, it's impactful work that I think is somewhat being lost in a lot of the noise. But to have that type of client load and to do that type of work is really impactful. You know, as a firm, we feel we are blessed, and as am I, to do that, right?
Tell us a little bit about that. How is Uber hoping to help bring healthcare services in the pandemic or post-pandemic?
So because, you know, Uber has reach, you know, across the entire country in terms yep. of drivers, and people are certainly well aware of Uber, what they're able to do is through their Uber Health platform is they can partner with, whether it be health plans, whether it be doctors, medical providers, nonprofit groups, community of interest, and to pick up a patient or to pick up an elderly person and get them to the doctor safely, and then make sure that that patient is spending a limited amount of time at the office, in the doctor's office. And when the appointment's complete, the car is waiting for them and takes them home. If the patient needs to go get prescription drugs, the driver will take them to get the prescription drugs. It helps address medical adherence. Mm-hmm. One of the big issues when people go to the doctor is they go to the doctor, they get the prescription, and they never fill it, right?
Right.
And so part of the Uber Health app approach is that they'll take them to pick up their prescription as well. And then they take them home. It also cuts down on wait time, where they're not having, COVID time's different, right? Because a lot of the medical buses that would go around and pick up all the folks, and then they would take them, everybody, and drop them off, and then they come back, pick them up. Those aren't working too well.
Can't do that now.
Right? And so now you have a safe and secure way to get a patient to the doctor.
That's great. So I would imagine, as you obviously work very closely with Uber and Justin, have you been tempted to go inside?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've been tempted, but why have you decided to stay in your current role? Or not just with Uber, with any company
totally
like
right.
that. Yeah,
totally right. Uber was the one client I had, right? I was like, I seriously said, you know what? If the right opportunity came about, that would be one that I would have jumped for. And this was pre-IPO, right? Because mm-hmm. I just fundamentally believed in what they were doing. But I have a lifestyle, not economically, but just living in the mountains. And so many jobs that I could move on to, a head of office or a senior vice president of global government affairs or something like that. Pre-COVID, it would have required me to move to the location where that company is domiciled. And, you know, let's be honest, I live at 7,700 feet above sea level, and I like my lifestyle. I run ultra marathons, and I can do it right out my back door. And so
I can hear the birds.
Yeah.
Sounds like a hawk or something. Maybe an eagle.
That's a hawk. We have bear, hawk, raccoon, elk, deer, no wolves yet. Some people are trying to bring them here. I say no, but yeah, we have a lot of wildlife.
Well, but the key thing you said, Stephen, is pre-COVID, post-COVID, those jobs may be available anywhere. Yeah. Really going to be a very, very different world.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then it's marrying up something that I fundamentally care about, want to do. And, you know, what's the cost benefit of that, or the opportunity cost? One thing I love about consulting is, and, you know, Craig Patty, when I was at Dutco, taught me something that was really informative. And that is, when you build the business and you identify clients you want to work with, A, you always want to have a cool client. B, you always want to have a client that has like really bad issues, because they're always going to need you. And C, you're going to want a dream client. a client that there's no way in heck I'm ever going to get that client. But if I could get one client, that's your dream client. And you just kind of work towards that end. And then I've been blessed. I had a cool client, Tesla. Pretty awesome, right? Great, great company. Helped them out. Helped do some really great stuff for them. Gig factory in Nevada and do some work for them in Colorado with governors. That's a cool client. My dream client was Uber, where no way in heck should I have ever been able to land Uber was the mindset. But I just kept plodding along and plodding along. And it's super important for folks to know that if you set a goal, you know, you can actually work towards it and achieve it. But if you never write your goals down, you're never going to achieve them.
Why is that? Why is that that they say writing the goals down is so important?
I think it allows you to visualize and remind yourself. And one thing I tell my team is plan your work and then work your plan, right? What a wonderful world it would be if we could just all just kind of fly around and not necessarily have an objective in mind or a goal to work towards. So you have to put a plan to paper, and then you can constantly reflect on it, make sure you're taking the right steps to get to where you need to go. You know, I said a moment ago, I do ultra marathons. And one of the reasons that I enjoy ultra marathons is you can't cut corners. You have to put in the work, you know, you have to go out and run 10 miles today or 15 miles or 20 or 7. You have to go climb 4,000 or 5,000 feet of elevation gain. And each day builds upon the others, and each year builds upon the next. And so when you toe the line at the race, you know your outcome, you know everything you put into it. And short of, you know, blowing up in the race or not being able to fuel or not being able to do something that's outside of your control. But if you know you put in the work and you know you set the goal that I want to run 100 miles or I want to run 70 or I want to run 50, whatever the marker is, you have to put in the work. So you have to plan it. And I apply that same level of rigor to the work that I do and that we do for our clients. When a client comes and hires us and say, hey, you know, we fundamentally want to impact the debate or the conversation in a particular area. Well, then we say, okay, first step is we got to do a SWOT. Let's figure it out. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. And we add an extra T, targets, right? If you're capturing business, let's build the plan. And then we all agree to the plan. And then we all execute against the plan. And then when we meet with the clients, you go through the plan. Where are we in these steps? You know, some people think lobbying is pixie dust. It's not. You know, lobbying is foundational. And you've got to build it up, develop the messaging, develop the right contacts, develop the right timing and sequencing. And that's, you know, that's how I've always structured my work. And I always call back on my business degree and helping me think that way. I didn't study political science. I've lived it, right? I have an undergraduate degree in business, but I have a master's degree in political science through life. But it's the business degree that actually has been foundational to the growth. And then it's the experiential learning that has enabled me to kind of apply both of those disciplines, you know, to help clients achieve some pretty significant outcomes.
Justin originally hired you at Uber. So at that point, you were at Dutco?
I was at Dutco, yeah.
And were there other firms trying to get the business? And why do you think, I think our listeners will find this helpful. Why do you think, you said plodding along, you know, here you are. You obviously know that Uber is looking for some help in DC and across the country. Tell us about that.
I don't know if Uber was looking at other firms, because I presented to him a strategic consideration that I don't necessarily know if Justin was thinking about. You know, he and Corey were firemen, like Fire Marshal Jim, right? Just running around and whacking them all and everything that was popping up.
So he's talking about Corey Owens, also a previous guest on the show, as Justin has been. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. And what I came in and talked to them about is look, you know, the theater is the whole country. And the regulatory regime is under the direct leadership of the Office of the Governor. And many of the core decisions that are be impacting Uber's viability in particular markets was it's at most levels, governors would play a very key role in that. And, you know, Uber was already very active with the attorneys general because there was, you know, they were looking at what Uber was doing at the behest of taxi, right? Because how could a company come in and blow up a marketplace and do something that some would argue is illegal because they didn't ask for permission. They begged for forgiveness, right? That's well documented. And so I think the model that we presented to them of like, look, let us help you develop these relationships with governors, think through strategy at a higher level, and then filter it down to the states in terms of, you know, run bills, but first get the blocking and tackling done with the governor's office. It was a little bit of an innovative approach to Justin. You know, I presume Justin was being approached by others. I think he and I developed like an appreciation for one another. You know, we both have had to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps in our life and kind of fight and to get to where we are. And we both seem to have a similar can-do attitude. And I'm gonna take that dang hill. Let's take the hill. And he and I just really hit it off on a personal level. And thankfully, I think the approach was right, because the work that we were brought on to do, remember, we're the Sherpa, and as the Uber Sherpa with in the states and with governors, and because of the experience with which I brought forward, right, tobacco and pharma and campaigns to this disruptive company that was, their team members were relatively young and hardworking. By golly, they were hardworking. These folks, I mean, I would be on calls with Uber at 6 a.m. and go to bed at 11 o'clock and hang up from an Uber call every day of the week, you know, for 3 to 4 years. But it was that body of experience that I brought forward, and that I was an advisor to many of the folks that he brought onto his team, because Justin was so busy building and managing a team that invariably, you know, I would get a call from someone on the team like, hey, Justin said I should give you a call and talk about this. What do you think strategically? What are the strategic considerations that we should put into play in this market to, you know, effectuate change to help us achieve the desired outcome that we want? I was involved in nearly every market that Uber opened up at some level. Some of it was Harvey Keitel, where I'd have to come in and I'd have to fix some stuff that was done before because they were fast and moving. Not doing anything inappropriate, but just have to kind of go in and kind of polish and settle the waters a little bit, right? And wow, it was great. It was absolutely fundamental. And it was funny because some markets we would just work so hard to open up. And Kansas is one of them. People like Kansas, you know, Kansas, middle of America, right? And they were one of the later adopters of having Uber actually come online. And we finally were successful in working out on refining all of the bills. Insurance was the hang up there. And we finally resolved it. And driver zero is what Uber calls the very first rider in the state. And we always tried to have driver zero be a governor. And so, you know, the governor agreed to do it. And, you know, he signs the bill into law. We're out in front of the Capitol and he hops into the Uber and he drives away. And as he's driving away, I look at the car and I'm like, holy smokes, we just got it done in Kansas. And the car had Nebraska license. And I just went, oh my God, all this hard work, right? You couldn't use the photo op because the governor's in a car from Nebraska. But that was just early days Uber. It was absolutely transformative. And the battles in Nevada, you know, and what the Griffin brothers would do there relative to helping, you know, get the bills run in the legislature and ultimately become law. And I would stay back, you know, in the office in Reno and keep talking through strategy and tactics with the Uber lobbyists. Sometimes Uber lobbyists, because maybe they came from a campaign background, they didn't necessarily know like the core competencies of kind of how sausage was made. You know, sometimes I would just sit back with them and just talk about how sausage was made. So they would be ready for the next market. But it was amazing. It was an incredible opportunity. And to be able to still do their work and to grow with them. And to see the success and the tremendous leadership that Dar has brought to that company and the rigor and really moved them away from the cowboy mentality into a sustainable business. It's a proud, proud moment in my life and career to have been a part of that, you know? So yeah, I think that's why Justin and I work so well together. It's just, we've been in a lot of ditches, a lot of ditches.
The Sherpa term. We'll have to see about how many people get that added to their contract.
Yeah.
So now you like bringing in clients and you're good at looking ahead. When you look down the road, what are you thinking about now? What industries or even companies or areas are of interest to you?
Yeah. You know, I've always had a robust portfolio of work in the healthcare space. You know, antibodies, you know, now that we're going through the pandemic, working with companies that are working on antibodies, figuring out how do we incentivize companies to develop you know, novel medicine to tackle some of these issues that are out there now. I mean, COVID-19, it's rough, but it also shows you kind of the magic in medicine, in science, you know, and to sit in some of these briefings and learn about and hear about what some of these companies are doing and the pathway that they're going through in discovery, while at the same time to be under such significant pressure in terms of pricing, and that they still put their heart and mind in the work. You know, if that doesn't get you excited and motivated and feel good about what you do, I don't think you're living. So healthcare will always be a foundational component to what is going on. Still doing work in the gig economy, and you know, there's other markets that are going to be disrupted in the gig by the gig economy, especially now that so much of work is occurring outside the office. You know, I think you're going to anticipate seeing more pressures on from a legislative side on what does that mean in terms of tax and implications to state budgets, and can a worker who's living in state X but you know performing work for a company in state Y, how will that revenue be treated? I don't know if you saw yesterday, you know, the state of New Hampshire filed a suit, Supreme Court, against the state of Massachusetts, because so many people who work in Massachusetts live in New Hampshire, but during COVID, they've not gone down to Massachusetts to work. And as I understand it, Massachusetts is trying to claw back that money from people who hadn't even stepped foot in that state. And so those types of things are going to create public policy issues and stuff like that. It's far-reaching and it's broad and it's deep. So I think those are some of the emerging. Travel industry is another one where you're going to see further movement there in terms of issues that they're going to have to grapple with. You know, Airbnb and HomeAway, neither of which are clients, but you know, how are they going to survive? And what's going to happen in the policy regime that's going to impact their ability to thrive moving forward? It's, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there. You know, one thing I'm proud of is, you know, the work that I do with Comcast and, you know, broadband. You know, everybody is, you think about it, all the people working from home during COVID. And, you know, there's some people that might argue that, oh, you know, our broadband coverage isn't that great. But you know what? Broadband coverage in our country is pretty unbelievable. And to not have cataclysmic failure in broadband and the ability for our nation and the country and the world to stay connected during these times, every single company that provides broadband and every single company that provides Wi-Fi and cellular, they all deserve like a round, a standing ovation, because what we have in place is really fantastic. So I would think that there'll probably be some follow-on policy efforts made in the broadband space, because they're, I think through this, there may be some gaps that people have identified, but fixing a gap is a heck of a lot better than fixing an entire system, right? And so that may be another area.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I was reading the other day that, you know, someone was talking about 5 years ago, if we were in this pandemic, we would not be able to, you know, the Zoom calls and all the, you know, the bandwidth that we need at home, we wouldn't have. And just, you know, the fact that we're in this, they called it the post-bandwidth economy, that with the way the bandwidth is today, that you can actually work seamlessly from most homes. You know, so whether you're a lawyer or a consultant or whatever, you know, these people, investment bankers in New York, you know, we're talking to a an entire trading floor desk are still working remotely.
Yeah.
And some of the traders are in Phoenix, some are in Nantucket. And, you know, just what you were saying, it's incredible. 5 years ago, that would not have been possible. They could have done it, but it would not have been as seamless. We would not be, right now we're on a video call. This would have been a little choppy 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, I live in the mountains and we have perfect signal, right? And you see people now pursuing a lifestyle coupled with their job. So then you're going to see, you know, other public policy considerations are going to have to come into play there, right? Like something that people are fond of saying in Colorado now is we're loving Colorado to death, where there's so many people that are now going on trail, and there's so many people now that are moving here, and there's so many people now that are climbing the Flatirons and going to Hanging Lake, that there's like this overutilization of our resources. Hmm. And it's like, what do you do? And so if you think about states like Montana and Idaho and Wyoming, and that where people are wanting to move to because they want to pursue a lifestyle, and they know that they can still do their job from there, you know, those states are going to have to address those issues.
Yes.
At some level.
Yes.
How are they going to handle this? And then cities like San Francisco, where you have this flight of people who are just companies that are moving out because, you know what? We don't want to be there anymore. Either it's cost.
Right. And several companies have said all workers can work remote all the way through 2021.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're a big tech company, you know, as you were just saying, it's a lot cheaper to have someone working in Tennessee rather than San Francisco, you know? Yeah, it's going to be very different. All right. This interview was postponed because of your ultra marathon. So what was the ultra marathon? How far was it? And how did you do?
Yeah, it was good. It was, which one was it? It was 100K.
100K. Wow.
So that's 62 miles and like, I think it had like 8,500 feet of elevation gain and descent. One of the human potential races, which is it's actually a race series in Colorado. And would you believe they did not have to cancel a single race this year? So I did 100K. I did a 50 miler and 225 milers this year. But the big news is I got confirmation that I'm in Leadville 100 again next year. I got that email this morning, which will be, you know, that's one of the greatest races in the ultra world.
Tell our listeners about that race.
Well, Leadville 100 is, it's run at Leadville, Colorado, which is the highest incorporated city in the country. You tow the starting line at about 10,000 feet. All in, it's 100 mile, about 16,500 feet of elevation gain and descent over the race. You have to finish the race in 30 hours. It's one of the most storied ultras out there. Ken Klober, who founded it, was actually a former Colorado State Senator, and he and I have been friends for many years. And he's got a couple of great expressions. Is when you run an ultra, you know, you become best friends with pain. That's one. The other one he uses is you can do more than you think you can, and you got to dig deep. Now, two of the three I use in my work. You know, dig deep and do more than you think you can. And it's important, right? The ultra mindset is, for me, it's core.
That's incredible. The 100K that you just did, how long did it take you to finish?
Race started at 4 and I rolled in at midnight.
Wow.
So whatever. Yeah, I'm older. I'm slow.
So you were running or moving for 16 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Or thereabouts. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I wish I could do it faster. But I don't. And
Stephen, just let's get one thing straight. Everyone is quite impressed the fact that you did that. I don't think anyone is. Yeah. That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Kind of like a political campaign, right? It's an ultra.
No, actually, Stephen, it's not like a political campaign. It's it's much, much worse. Oh, my God. That is incredible. Wow. Well, congratulations. Stephen, it's been great to have you on the show. Great to hear about your career. I am glad that we were finally able to put this together. And great to hear all about your work at Forbes Tate. And we wish you all the best. And to our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also sign up for our Monday morning email at thepoliticallife.net. It comes out every Monday and has little tidbits and information along with our show. So remember to stay safe, stay healthy, and we will see you next Monday.